Good afternoon and welcome. I don't know, if I were attending reunion, I would just keep talking too, but, you know, it's the built-in respect for authority. Welcome for those of you who are here for reunion. Welcome back. It's very exciting to see you. I'm sorry that there was some miscommunication and some people had difficulty gaining entry. But now that we're all here, properly attired, with my apologies, I'm glad you're here and I hope you get to see old friends and meet one another. We're going to turn to the intellectual components of the event in a minute, but I wanted to remind you that I hope to see you, other than those who previously signed up for an afternoon tour. I think our next large-scale event is Wine Mess, so to speak, at Millennium Park on Randolph across the way. The place looks great, and I look forward to seeing you there. We'll have some students there as well, so that you can show people you were with that you once looked like that. And move like that as well, though there is an elevator for the rest of us. Richard Epstein, who's our speaker today, doesn't require too much of an introduction, I think. But I do want to say something about the topic and the format. So as you remember from law school, one is not permitted to give a speech to a University of Chicago law school audience without having ferociously interesting and difficult questions afterwards. So Richard will leave time for questions, and if he doesn't, just do what he would do and scream them out or raise your hand or something of the sort. I was pleased when I asked Richard to give a talk at today's lunch without knowing what topic he would pick. And then I saw the topic, which made me very happy, because I have to say, I find this topic everywhere, even outside of pharmaceuticals. So, for example, it always seemed to me that we were subsidizing the world at the time of the Olympics and the World Cup, because we didn't have this single buyer, seller, national television station, but we would pay billions for Olympic coverage, while the French, it's always a good idea in Chicago to pick on the French, while the French would pay, you know, $50 million or something to give Olympic coverage. And it always seemed like there was something wrong with this sort of price discrimination where free enterprise came back to haunt us. And I think that's what we're going to find out about in terms of things far more important than the Olympics. So I give you our favorite person to ask questions of, Richard Epstein.
On behalf of our two speakers, I, the moderator, Richard Epstein, are very happy to come here. And let me sort of introduce them to you both very briefly. Can you hear me? Or can you hear them?
Closer.
Close.
There's a clip on.
Oh, is there a clip on? I was going to sing into the microphone just to see if I could attract everybody's attention, but now I'm afraid I'll have to speak. But this is supposed to be a debate, and I'm the moderator, and we have speakers on my left and their right, both of whom are known to speak too rapidly for their own good. And the major constraint that I'm going to tell them, since it's only about 5 or 6 minutes aside, is that they're not allowed to up the rate of their delivery in order to compensate for the shortness of their time. That being said, let me see if I can introduce the topic that they're going to talk about. We are talking not only about the Olympics, but also it seems very clear in the last week there have been very major changes in the ways in which the pharmaceutical industry has been approached, both domestically and foreign. This is not on?
No.
Oh, high tech. Chicago has always been a leader in the world of intellectual property and computer devices. But there's been actually on the pharmaceutical area, and I probably should take some of their medicines right now in order to continue with this talk. It turns out there are at least examples of straws in the wind, two powerful developments. On the international front, there have been situations where the Brazilian government and the Thai government have announced that they're going to issue compulsory licenses for patented drugs held by American companies because of their inability to reach price agreements with respect to the way in which they will be distributed there. And on the domestic front, just yesterday, Senator Dorgan having managed to reintroduce with about 25 sponsors, including our own Senator Obama, a bill which is designed to allow for the reimportation of drugs from Canada and 33 other countries into the United States at prices which will be determined by the prices at which these drugs are to be sold overseas for their own internal consumption. So what we do is we see that there is on the domestic front and on the foreign front lots of pressures with respect to the way in which the pharmaceutical industry is pricing and selling its wares. And what we do is we have two very eminent speakers who will need no introduction to talk about it. The first is, going to take the proposition that America is in fact improperly subsidizing foreign countries and that something ought to be done about it. And then on the opposite side, we shall have a notable left-wing firebrand who will take the position that America does not do enough to discharge its obligations to the rest of the civilized world. So without further ado, I will have my first speaker come here and give his introduction, then the second. There'll be no time for rebuttal, but the moderator will reserve the opportunity to correct both of them for their previous errors. Thank you. The low-tech guy again. Hi, my name is Richard Epstein, and I want you to know I'm a defender of American capitalism in its finest and most glorious tradition. I'm here today to try to explain why it is truly outrageous that the entire operation of the drug industry rests upon exploiting American consumers for the benefit of people overseas. It is well understood, regrettably so, that the cost of the identical product, with the identical products, properties in the United States can be four, five, six times as much as the same drug with the same properties when being sold overseas. This situation is one which arises from the fact that the American companies spend all the time, energy, and imagination on research with respect to these drugs, and the foreign companies, these countries, resolve a variety of dubious tactics in order to be able to get our stuff at bargain-based prices. How does this thing start to work? Well, the first thing that happens is, in the United States, we have a decent free enterprise system where property rights and patents are, in general, respected, and overseas you have monopsony buyers who dictate a single price at which the goods can be sold inside their countries. The net effect of all of this turns out to be that prices are going to be pushed way down close to their marginal cost, which means that the huge necessary expenses to develop these drugs are all going to be forced back on the backs of American consumers. What is it that can the tactics that are used for this in addition to the monopoly? Well, it turns out that these guys overseas are sometimes even more reckless than that. If you look at the TRIPS agreement under Article 31, it says that if commercial negotiations break down, then it turns out that countries can issue compulsory licenses upon payments of just compensation of sorts, and then simply reproduce the drugs in their own company through their own countries through generic manufacturing. Well, it turns out that these negotiations often do break down, but not for commercial reasons. They broke down in Thailand, they broke down in Brazil. Why? Because they didn't want to say the same kind of prices that are paid everywhere else throughout the world. And what they did is they will now issue these licenses. These drugs will be made by somebody else. And therefore, what will happen is we will make the inventions, other people will turn out to get all the revenues. Well, is this going to happen lots of times? I think the answer to that question is no. Most American companies would rather get something than nothing. And so given the threat not only of the refusal to allow the drug to be sold, but patent invalidation, they will be forced to crumble. They won't be able to do anything about it. The question then is, what should we as the United States do about this outrageous and outlandish situation? It seems to me the answer is perfectly clear. What we have to do is to get all of our political energy, might, and organization behind it so as to make sure that foreign governments recognize that they have to bear their fair share. It may well be that if they don't pay for individual patented drugs, they're going to have to contribute the funds which can be distributed to our research companies in order to defray the costs in question. But the one thing that turns out to be certain is that we cannot continue to survive, we cannot continue to prosper, if everybody else can free ride while we take all the burden of innovation and imagination and get nothing in return. So thank you very much. It seems to me that this case is simple enough and straightforward enough that it needs no further elaboration. If that other guy can say something that makes sense, let him try, but I'm going to go sit down. Thank you. Second speaker come forward who will present a rather different view of the situation. He turns out to be our left winger sitting on the right. ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the most heartless, outrageous, egotistical, singly directed speech that you will ever hear on a topic of this importance and merit. It is often said about Americans, and indeed I am one, regrettably, that they tend to look at the rest of the world as though it's some distant place out there. They do not understand any of the complexities and difficulties of living in a complex international environment. But the basic problem is exactly the opposite of what it is that our speaker has said. We have a world in which thousands of people are dying of AIDS, in countries in which incomes are sometimes as little as a dollar a day. And what temerity, what outrageous behavior on the part of American firms to think that they can charge people in these countries the same prices that they can charge in a place which is rich with the corrupted fruits of American capitalism. The proper association under these circumstances is to drive the cost down as low as possible, because this is a world in which it turns out that profit should come second and that people should come first. And how is it that we ought to do with this? Well, we try it in two ways. One is we beg and we plead for them to lower the cost. We know that an additional unit of drugs sent to our countries costs these companies only pennies, sometimes dollars. And for this, they want to charge 5, 6, and 10 times that marginal cost. And then they get adamant and they play tough with us. And we finally find ourselves in the position where there's only one thing that we can do. And what is that? We have to issue compulsory licenses to allow these drugs to be produced at a cost that we can do. And think of the insanity that's associated with all of this. If they sold it to us at the prices that we're willing to pay, it's not going to diminish the amount of money that they could recover in the domestic market in the United States. Why would they not want to do a good deed when in fact they could be no worse off than if they had done nothing at all? And indeed, if they start to think about a remedy, they have only themselves to look at. If they believe, unlike the rest of the civilized world, that national health care should not be a right supported universally by all individuals, if they really think that patentees should have complete price freedom over their products, let them suffer. But in fact, we don't believe that most Americans believe that. Quite the opposite. When somebody from overseas looks at the United States, they rejoice at the prospect that America is finally going to handle the problem of price imbalance, not by raising the prices that are charged overseas, as my opponent has suggested. No, what they are going to do is they are going to lower the prices domestically by allowing importation from foreign governments at prices which are charged overseas. So essentially, the imbalance can end, and the way in which it ends is by leveling down in prices rather than by leveling up. We all know that the pharmaceutical industry has the highest rate of profit of any major industry in the world. Why on earth should it be allowed to prosper off the backs of ordinary citizens? So again, I think the case is really quite simple. This is not a case of subsidy. The United States can do what it wants in its prices. We'll do what we want in our countries. And it turns out, if we're right about the way in which we do things overseas, then those who live in America should rethink the way in which they deal with drugs there. Thank you. Well, it turns out we've heard from two speakers, and the only thing it seems to me that they agree on is the passion with which they hold their position. The question, however, we have to decide is who is right. And the answer is, it's probably, I think, on balance, too close to call. But let me see if I can explain to you why it is that both of these characters have not followed the first and most sacred principles of all analysis, those of the classical economic school developed and nourished and made famous by this University of Chicago. Here is the basic problem that we have to face in the drug question. And it goes back to a famous article written by Ronald Coase in 1946 called The Marginal Cost Controversy. Notice, by the way, that your moderator is much more learned than either of these two insignificant debaters who sit to his left or to his right. And what this article had to worry about was the question with bridges, but it applies to drugs. It cost you $1 million to build a bridge, or it cost you $1 billion to make a drug. But once it's made, it costs you only pennies for somebody to go over the bridge or to consume the drug.
how do you price it? Well, the price problem here is that everybody wants to pay for the second trip or the second drug. Nobody wants to pay for the first one. The pharmaceutical companies are in an impossible position because everybody says, we'll pay marginal cost, let somebody else pay fixed cost. And so there is now this huge, complicated game in which people are always trying to offload that front-end cost onto somebody else. And in this particular situation, inside the American economy, we have generally allowed for open pricing. And so it is natural that most of the high front-end costs will be distributed in the places where pricing are relatively free. Overseas, of course, it turns out that they have monopsony power. And so there, they're willing to force that price down. Does this make American companies worse off? Well, put it this way. If it turns out that by buying a good at 10 cents, when it costs you only 5 cents to produce it, they've actually contributed something to the fixed costs that have to be borne. So in an odd sense, overseas, even though they pay less than they do in the United States, they make these drugs, in fact, more likely to come on the market by covering some of these fixed costs. So what's the real problem here? Well, it turns out that both these guys are a little bit confused. The prices in America are not going to be influenced by the prices that are charged overseas. Anybody in the United States will figure out how to maximize, God forbid, but nonetheless true, its profits in this country. And if the maximizing price and strategy pricing sales is a certain way in the United States, you're going to do that whether you make money overseas or whether you don't make money overseas. So long as there's no arbitrage back and forth between the markets, which is in fact a serious risk, then in effect you'll price separately. So, does foreign stuff influence America? Does it influence the world? Yes, but in a different way than is commonly presupposed. And both of our NINI speakers didn't quite get this right. And that's the following point. If, in fact, you reduce the expected return by price controls anywhere throughout the globe, it's going to be infected and influence the decisions of people to make initial investment. So it's not the short-term dispute that's really an issue. It's the long-term question. How much investment are you going to get? And so therefore, when they decide in Thailand that they want to lower the prices that are paid there, they're not only hurting people in the United States, they're hurting people in India and China, everywhere else, because by the extent to which you reduce pricing freedom in the second stage of this game, what you do is you reduce incentives to invest in the first stage. So then you ask, well, what's the moral answer to this question? And the hard thing is, nobody has ever come up to a solution of what the optimal pricing is with respect to the bridge. And so therefore, nobody has come up to a solution with respect to the pharmaceuticals. What is it that one therefore ought to do? Our moderator has to ask himself. And his inclination has always been to, by and large, try to keep government out of it and then use all sorts of complicated bidding processes. In his view, that's my view, I think what you want to do is to have high prices as a magnet to drawing in new drugs so that the monopoly problem is solved by competition rather than being solved by government fiat. So, generally speaking, both these guys are a little bit speaking through their head. The politics is very intense. It's clear that the pharmaceutical companies are on the defensive. And it's extremely difficult in working these kinds of debates to get people to focus on long-term incentives under circumstances where short-term distributional issues which raise such passion are involved. And to give you but one example as to how the debate works the other way, we've had a huge debate in the United States over Medicare Part D, which is prescription drugs. And at that particular point, the government and many supporters of national purchase have said, look, we could lower the price. But the effect of the only way you could lower the price is to actually lower the selection of people. And we find that now you're not worried about long-term versus short-term effects. You're worried about people who say, well, I can't get the newest drugs for 2 years. I don't want to be in a low-price program. And the real difference is that so long as current consumers think that they're fine with lower prices, they will tend to understate the concerns of long-term future consumers who will in fact be benefited by higher prices. So we get a kind of very difficult Rawlsian problem, how you create justice between the generations. And on that rather skeptical note, I'm going to tell our two guys on the quiet side to be quiet. I'm now going to be the moderator and answer any more questions for them, because frankly, I don't trust either of them to speak any further. Thank you. I touched the first hand.
Coming from Chicago, and not only the spirit of medieval scholasticism, but also empiricism.
That's a long time ago.
It is a long time ago. I'm starting to get gray hair. The question isn't it as a matter of empirical data that you still have substantial efforts to develop new drugs in Europe where their markets are controlled in the way both speakers have described, and therefore that the conclusion is that the overall long-term implications are not so clear as to what will happen, because where there's profit to be derived, even if the profit isn't at the august levels that we've traditionally had in America for the pharma industry, that they'll still have sufficient profit incentive there to continue R&D to develop medication.
There's always going to be some incentive, but here's the mistake, I think, in the argument. There's a lot of efforts to try... Oh, let me repeat the question, since Marsha will kill me if I don't. The basic question is, given the fact that if you look in European markets where there are heavy price controls, you still see fairly strong incentives to develop drugs, why is it that you think that pricing freedom is going to be essential to keep this thing up at its current high level? I think there are a couple of answers to it. One is, part of the reason why much of the initial development takes place in Europe now is not so much a function of pricing, it's a function of hospitability to research endeavors, whether it be on the stem cell stuff, which has been sufficiently important now that whole entire U.S. research teams have in fact relocated overseas, where the objections are much weaker than they are here, and in fact what they think to be a less oppressive day-to-day environment in terms of regulating such things as human subjects, researchers, and clinical trials of one kind or another. But the strategy overseas is they are not making these drugs for the European market. They are making these drugs for the American market with the pricing fixed. And if you start look at what's going on, the average date of introduction of drugs is earlier here than it is there, because these patent drugs are perfectly portable. And virtually every European lawyer knows American patent law, and every American lawyer knows European patent law. And therefore, the strategy that we're seeing is that the research will be done overseas in a hospitable environment, and the sales will, for the most part, start to take place here. If you shut down the spigot on this side by controlling the pricing, what will happen is the research will still take place overseas, but like everything else, there's no such thing as a change in demand or price, which doesn't produce a change in initiative and responses. And we have done studies on this, and essentially, venture capitalists are not the people about whom you'd say they're utterly impervious to changes in their legal environment or their profit picture. These are the guys who see it first, and not only that, the great worry is that if there's uncertainty, they back off today, and that will really influence things, not so much tomorrow, because those drugs are already in the pipeline, but will influence things very heavily if we wait another 5 to 10 years. Right now, the American difficulty, of course, is with the FDA, is clinical trials just get longer and longer. And at this particular point, a 20-year patent gives you 8 to 9 years of useful life. That's something that you've got to think about as being a rather scary kind of scenario, at least in the domestic front. So I think that there's all sorts of ambiguities and difficulties in running this market, but I see no optimistic solution to it, as the question seems to imply. So next question. Yes, oh my God, it's going around the table.
Well, you just handed me the lead into my question, because I was going to ask about what if we start the patent running when the drug is introduced rather than way before the clinical trials start, and how's that going to affect the variable pricing between the U.S. and the rest of the country?
The question has been asked, suppose what we do is we change the time at which the patent starts to run from the date at which the claim is filed to the date at which you get marketing approval. This, or some version of this, was actually proposed way back in the 1980s when they passed the 1984 Hatch-Waxman Act. Now, this piece of legislation, both Hatch and Waxman, by the way, are still around, was a compromise. Hatch wanted actually fairly strong intellectual property protections in the form of day-to-day postponement. Each day you're in clinical trials is a day that you get a patent extension. Waxman was less cordial on that front, and they eventually settled on a compromise that you get 1 day patent extension for each 2 days you're in the FDA mix up to a period of 5 years. And in 1984, when the terms were relatively low, adding on 30 months actually made a difference. But as the terms get longer and the cost of invention get higher, that period, it seems, clearly too short. What you have proposed, in effect, is far more radical than anything could ever get through, because what you're doing is you're raising the effective year of an exclusive patent from basically 8 or 9 years up to 20 years again, and I can tell you the political climate in this country doesn't get close to supporting that. In fact, if I had to guess which way things would go on the patent front, looking at both the
the Supreme Court decisions on all sorts of topics, and also the attitude in Congress, I don't think there's much likely to be a movement in this particular direction, although I certainly would favor one. Even if you don't go 20 years, this is something for which compromise is surely possible, and you could just make it year to year up to 5 years, a year to year up to 7 years, and see the way in which it goes. And it would have the very nice feature that now everybody would be clamoring to get these drugs out on the market a little bit sooner, so the generics could come in a little bit sooner otherwise. So I support that kind of proposal, and it will certainly make a difference. But remember, having a patent and not being able to sell at a market price is scant consolation. So if you put a system of confiscatory price controls, a longer patent subject to very heavy regulation is going to simply reorganize the return. It's not going to increase it in the aggregate. So you have to take into account both effects. And how does one start to think about this? Well, patents are extremely difficult items on which to use rate of return regulations as you do with other monopolies. Because when you invest in a utility, you know that basically every dollar you put in is part of the rate base. What's the rate base for a patent? How do you put into the base the 19 drugs that fail, given the 20th that succeed? And unless you know what the rate base is, you don't know what the rate of return is. So what we've always done is adopted exactly the opposite strategy. We have no rate of return regulation. But when you file a patent, you have to give the world all the information about how you got there so that they can now try to invent similar drugs not covered by the patent, which can become competitive rivals. And I think that that mechanism is much better than any clunky administrative device that is often in the airing. And right now you should understand about these bills, the Dorgan bill. If Canada sets a monopsony price for importation, that becomes the price in the United States. And so it's sure that this bill will be absolutely challenged on some kind of constitutional grounds. And my guess is the challenge I actually have under the existing law of rate regulation, a pretty good chance of success. It's a very draconian bill. And indeed, I haven't seen this version, but the previous version of the bill allowed somebody who could force a purchase in Canada at Canadian prices could sell it anywhere in the world. So that not only did we allow importation in the United States, we cut out any kind of monopoly price that we might be able to attract for a given patent overseas, hurting American companies without helping American consumers. This is what we call legislative drafting at its best, but that's what happened in the earlier version. In the back, yes?
Yeah. Suppose one accepts the argument of your left-wing, your right-wing speaker speaking from the left,
yeah,
and says, yeah, this is terribly unfair, the existing system, the subsidization, so on, very, very unfair. What's the difference? I mean, how can you possibly stop it? When every national sovereign state can do whatever the hell they want, they can confiscate the knowledge and sell it their country and let be done in their country, whatever they want to do. What relief is there available if you buy the argument?
The answer is actually, it's ominous. First of all, there's jawboning, which is a non-trivial item with respect to international affairs. It certainly has had and beginning to have more effect in places like China. The second thing is also retaliation. If you don't respect the kinds of patents that we have on goods going into Brazil and Thailand, we can put tariff sanctions on you for stuff coming back in, or disrespect intellectual property that you filed here, or condemn you as subsidiaries that do business in the United States in order to make good the losses that have been done. I really don't like these alternatives because the characteristic of every major trade dispute is that they always bring in innocent third parties in order to get at nations which have misbehaved. And so if you even look at other trade disputes, they're really bad on the importation of American stereo equipment. What we do is we take their fig producers and tell them they're being subject to a real tariff. And the fig guy says, what the hell did I do to deserve this? And in fact, the American consumers of figs ask exactly the same question from the other side. So I think the answer is that there is, short of going to war, which is a possibility, but not a real strong one, it is a matter of subtle diplomatic persuasion, influence, and so forth. I can tell you some things we could do, at least in some places, which would change things mightily. The single largest disgraces in American foreign policy are twofold. They are explicit subsidies with respect to foreign goods and explicit tariffs with respect to imports. What we have to do is engage in a policy of unilateral surrender with respect to both of these issues and change the situation so as to make more competitive institutions work effectively. This will benefit a lot of these third world countries. And then at that particular point, it seems to me you've got a much stronger case for saying, look, you guys should do it this way. There's also another way to do it. There's nothing which says, by the way, that if you want to sell goods cheaply in Brazil or in Thailand, that it's the manufacturers that have to subsidize them. my friend Bill Gates. I never met him, but he's a friend. You know, he's got a big foundation. He could buy some of that stuff and resell it at prices below cost. There are all sorts of other institutions that can intervene. And indeed, in some of the debates, it's really crazy. The actual debate that's taking place with respect to Abbott and Thailand is that Abbott developed an AIDS drug, cholesterol, in a form which is now heat-resistant, which is incredibly important in a place like that because it means that you don't have to refrigerate it. Well, if they double the cost of that relative to everything else, it's still going to be better for these guys to take it because they don't have to pay the collateral cost of refrigeration and take the dangers of losses and the dangers of improper distribution and application. So, I mean, in many of these cases, the patent increase prices leave people better off than they were before, even if it turns out they don't, as it were, negotiate any kind of a price cut from what is asked. And yet the whole TRIPS arrangement says that there's no resolution to the bilateral monopoly. It only says if the commercially reasonable attempts break down, doesn't tell you who judges that, then you could really throw the boom. Oh, David, do I have to take your question?
You don't have to.
But I will anyhow. He always asks the hard questions.
Aren't you conflating separate issues, which is price controls and sort of Western developed countries and sort of the pricing policies there versus the issue of sort of developing nations and sort of the patent issues there? I mean, they're extraordinarily different and there are sort of different implications for pricing in the States.
But the problem is it's a continuum. The question is put, am I conflating the way in which we look at developing countries with relative primitive resources as opposed to fairly sophisticated American companies overseas? And the way in which you see how difficult the question is, it's not clear quite where you want to put either Thailand or Brazil. Neither of them would fall into the behemoths of Europe, and neither of them fall into the desert economies of Saharan Africa. It's sort of somewhere in between. And indeed, the only reason they can play this thread is because they think they have internal capacity to actually generate a pharmaceutical industry at home, generic, which is sophisticated enough to make the drugs. So, I mean, I think the answer is there is certainly a continuum, but the difference is, I think, better played out in terms of the way in which you look at responses. I think virtually every American company has finally figured out that if you actually look at the effect of demand in a place like Mowali, you know, selling at marginal cost and a penny is not a bad deal even for you. And you know what? They've done it. I mean, this has already happened. The real problem there is not the cost of the drug. It's the cost of the drug distribution, by which I mean how do you get the drug from the dock into somebody's arms or mouth where it will actually do some good. And a lot of these countries want not only the drug, they also want them to supply the infrastructure, which is a much more dubious proposition. So I think that at that point, the answer is the market is, quote, taking care of that already. If you can stop resale and reshipment out to other countries, which turns out is always to be a bigger problem than you start to think, particularly when you're dealing with poor kleptocracies, a lot of this stuff just simply gets into one part of the pipeline and ends out in Hamburg on the deck, and somebody else reaps an intermediate profit. So it's certainly the correct answer. And one of the things that has happened is Patricia Danzen, who actually knows a lot about this stuff, she tried to run a regression. And the regression asked, how much do you pay overseas relative to national incomes, roughly speaking? And it turns out that one of the reasons why we pay higher prices in the United States, it's not the only reason, it's not just the monopsony issue, it's actually the demand curves look differently as a function of overall wealth and the amount of subsidies that are given to the healthcare system. We may not have universal health care, but in many ways, we actually spend much more per unit person than they do in places which have the universal stuff. And indeed, with respect to many drugs, we're more intensive consumers of them than overseas. And that demand is exploited by the pharmaceutical companies. And we have devices at home trying to put rebates and caps on this for Medicaid people and so forth in an effort to see how we can subsidize consumers without subsidizing drug companies. So it isn't as though we know what the price is in America. All this is inane. It's like asking, what's the price of an airplane ticket from going to New York to Chicago, and there's 72 different prices for the 71 people on the airplane, right? It's just, it's like that in the drug business. So it's really terribly difficult to do this correctly. But this is obviously right, and my view about it is that if you're correct, then market forces actually will lead to price discrimination, and that my fellow over here will be wrong. But in effect, price discrimination doesn't necessarily require either expropriation or monopsony. So the guy on the other side has a point, too. See, I'm so even-handed, it's just marvelous. Yes?
A great deal of the justification of the restrictions on importation has been safety. Mm-hmm. And I take it that from what your two different speakers have said is that it's a duplicitous argument, and that really this is an economic analysis that is most valid. And given the size of Canada and given the size of the domestic market here, why shouldn't we be able to use importation from Canada as just one other competitive element in pricing and in distribution and access here in the United States?
I didn't talk about safety. The question was, when you're talking about this, you just treat it as an economic discussion. I did that because it was a 15-minute talk. And then if it is an economic discussion, why are you ignoring safety? And once you put safety on the table, how does it change matters? And then once you do that, why is not the addition of competitive importations a form of additional competition? Those are the sorts of questions. Well, first of all, actually, I think the safety issue is extremely important in this particular case. And let me just explain to you something about the history. The first is a general proposition about FDA. It's generally useless on lots of things that it does, but contamination of supplies is an important issue. And the basic rule with respect to supply chains is the longer they get, then the more of them that are outside the scope and the jurisdiction of either the companies on the one hand or of the FDA on the other, the more likely it is that counterfeited stuff will get in there. Counterfeited stuff comes in two forms, one of which frightens the drug companies and the other which should frighten you. The ones that the drug companies hate are identical goods sold under bogus labels, right? So that it's not as though it's a danger to the consumer, but essentially what happens is somebody's imitating their brand and their mark or something of the sort. But there is a real problem of dilution and alteration. Years ago, Pfizer put together a memo which had, roughly speaking, the following title: 37 ways in which you could corrupt drug supplies. My favorite was thinning. And so what happens is you have an anesthetic, and this is used to put somebody out, and you just cut it in half, and they wake up midway through the surgery. I mean, this is not the kind of thing that you really want to have happen. The current Dorgan bill tries to deal with this, and the only method it has for doing it is to require that people present essentially a provenance, a paper dossier saying, I got this drug from somebody who got it from somebody, and everybody's copacetic. There's no actual independent check as to whether or not the documents could be forged under these circumstances. So, if just speaking for myself, I would never buy an imported good. I think the risks of having something which is labeled Canadian coming in from the Dominican Republic are really very, very strong. And you just don't know how you're going to stop it, because there's so many ways that you can get stuff in forged packages inside the stream of ordinary commerce that you can't get it out. So I think that's a serious, serious issue. Am I the only one who thinks this? No. I mean, it is interesting that both the Clinton FDA and the Bush FDA, when urged to do so, have refused to certify importations as though they've been safe. And I don't think that they're acting out of political motivations or out of deep and abiding affection for the drug companies. I think they understand exactly what I've just said, which is long supply chains really create major dangers. The Canadians have also taken a position which should put you into a somewhat of uneasiness. Their Minister of Health a couple of years ago stated quite publicly, look, we're a country which is about 1/20th or 1/18th or 1/15th of the size of the United States, 25 million people, whatever. And, you know, we're frankly not going to accept and inspect drugs when 90% of them are going to be used for the export market. We're not going to do that. We'll inspect those that are going to go into the internal distribution chain. Well, now, in effect, who's going to pick up those inspection calls? The bill tries to do that. But again, they say, well, anybody who wants to send stuff to the United States has to allow somebody to inspect their plants. That's not going to prevent corruption in the supply chain downstream. And it's going to create really messy authorities if the United States police people try to march into an Ontario building and say, hey, we're entitled to inspect this stuff under the statute. Somebody says, wait a second, you're not the sovereign. And the fact that these guys think that it's okay for you to come is not the same as saying that the Canadian Mounties want you to come. Get the hell out of here. It's a really complicated issue. So I don't think that you want to rest on the safety issues and think that those things are beside the point because I talked about the economic issue. Secondly, my colleague Ronald Coase, in talking about this question of competition many years ago, had this wonderful line. He's always in favor of competition, but he's always against the fifth column. And what's the difference? Well, this is not competition in a form in which Celebrex has to do with Vioxx or with Arcoxy or any other COX-2 inhibitor. This is a situation in which the so-called free trade argument is we mandate that American companies sell at a price to be determined by foreign governments, the quantities that foreign governments require. They have no right to refuse to deal under any circumstances. And then the goods that they're forced to sell are going to be put back into the company in competition with them, where they are told that they're going to have to wait their patent protection, which normally gives them the right to control the first sale of any patented drug inside the United States. I mean, this is the kind of competition in which, for example, what I'm allowed to do is to go into a GM showroom and say, I like all of these models, I'm going to order 50,000 of them. By the way, I'm only going to pay you what you pay in Seoul or somewhere else, and then you can deliver to me on the floor here and I'm going to sell them in competition with you. If you think that that kind of dragooning is free competition, then that's what you've got. It is really, it seems to me to be a failure of modern imagination to understand the difference between competition and confiscation. And that's exactly what's going on in this situation. It is no different from my saying to you, you know, I really like your house. I'm going to pay you a price which is designated by the Canadian government, and then I could sell it back in the American market to anybody I want at any other time. Forced sales at stated prices at below market value are confiscation to the level of the price difference. And I think once we understand that, you'll see why it is that this thing has a very rough road to hoe, even under rather narrow takings kinds of doctrines. I mean, the law is, of course, a mess, and nobody could predict anything. But the basic intellectual case is exceedingly strong that this statute is not competitive. Oh, my God, Anderson, you too. Oh, geez, all my hard students are coming after me.
It seems like that's the compulsory licensing regime that's the fundamental problem. So if you got rid of that, seems like you would solve 90% of the problems that you're talking about. Because the others, if you have governments seeking monopsony, buyers negotiating, there are a variety of market mechanisms that producers and other buyers here can use to deal with that. Because the compulsory licensing is the problem.
Well, there's actually a slight ambiguity in the terms. The question is whether or not the real problem is the compulsory licensing or whether it's the monopsony power. The difficulty with the Dorgan bill is it's neither. These are compulsory sales, not compulsory licenses. The intellectual property definition of a compulsory license is that I now have the right to make this drug to you under license. You are compelled to issue it, and we will set the price of the licensing. These are compulsory purchases of the patented goods, which is slightly different. There is no question that compulsory licensing is loathed by all major pharmaceutical companies. And the reason is that they understand that the compensation that you get through the compulsory licensing procedure will never put you in the same position you were in if you had the exclusive right to sell for the duration of the patented period. What they will do typically under these licensing arrangements is cover your marginal costs of production, which means that you get none of your fixed costs back at the front end and none of the monopoly profit that you would otherwise have. So you lose on the recoupment that you get from their sales, and of course your own sales get smashed, both in quantity and in the price that you get. So my rough estimate, speaking from the back of my pants, is that essentially any compulsory licensing regime probably gives you about 25% of what you would earn without it. So these are really big number differences. But these forced purchases, again, they're devastating, because if the Canadian government or the New Zealand government should decide, look, it's been a bad time here, we're going to lower our monopsony price by 5%, now all their importers can purchase at that price and resell in America. So essentially the American price-fixing scheme that's contemplated under this statute is figure out which of these 33 countries, including Bulgaria for whatever it is worth, has the lowest domestic price. That's where the importers will locate, and that's where, in effect, American companies will have to sell. So there'll be this weird sort of competition in which everybody will push the price down. If you're going to run price controls, which I don't like, run them domestically, be candid about it, and then set them internally instead of setting them by reference to somebody else's internal production decisions and consumption decisions based on entirely different motivations. Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, when I refer to compulsory licensing, I'm referring to both a compulsory license or a compulsory sale.
Yeah.
But it seems like when you talk about monopoly, it's not just that they're monopoly purchasers, in fact, they can compel the sale, that's the issue, not the fact
that... A monopsony purchase is a problem for American producers. There is no question if you had price freedom in Europe like you have in the United States, the prices would differ. I think the argument is it's impossible, as was stated in the back of the room, to figure out what you do in order to overcome the monopsony issue, because it's so integrally related to sovereign power and domestic operations, that unless you could prove that they're only monopsonists with respect to American goods but nobody else's goods, you're not going to have any kind of an international claim anywhere to win. The compulsory licensing issue is much more difficult given the general TRIPS pattern, that is, trade-related intellectual property agreement, which is in general more protective, but as I said, is somewhat loose in its language in Article 31. There's no question that the current status quo may not be ideal, but it's one in which there's monopsony without patent breaking. And what's happening now is a possibility that we will get both. Saul is going to come up here and ask not the last question, but since everybody's doing well, I think one or two more questions and then he can throw me off the podium, right? Yes?
I had this professor a long time ago talking about property rights.
Who's that?
One of the functions of government is to create and protect property rights. And fundamentally, when you look at this issue, I think it's a much bigger issue than just drugs. It affects intellectual property and the fair amount of the domestic output of what this country produces right now on the international scene. Because if you really got our foreign governments refusing to recognize the property rights system that we've created with these patents. You also used to talk about private property rights as an alternative to that. And the solution that a well-known manufacturer came up with called Coke is you don't make this public. You do private property rights. And I guess the question I have is whether this issue on the international scene is going to begin to move us to a private property rights system in these areas.
The question we're asking is whether or not the pressure that takes place on the patent system is going to increase the desirability to move something of a real private property system to with that which is associated with trade secrets, right? And the answer to that question is a resounding no. And let me see if I can explain to you what the difficulties in the argument turn out to be. The first thing is that trade secrets do not work with respect to product that is produced which has a known and determined chemical formula. It's not real difficult to reverse engineer the formula for Celebrex. It's a complex molecule to be sure, but take somebody a day and they could figure out what it is, and so they could produce it. The only thing that you can protect by way of a trade secret is the process by which you in the United States make this. So that's one thing. So it doesn't give you the protection for the product, which is what this market is about. The second thing is, do not assume that the long arm of government, which could wreck the trade secrets world, rather the patent world, can't also wreck the trade secrets world if you want. Right now, there's a big case in Europe about Microsoft and its violation of Section 81 and 82 of the European Code. And the chosen remedy in many cases is to require them to make public their trade secrets in ways that will allow people to replicate their equipment in exactly the same ways we worry about patents without having all the cost of investment. The American settlement on this, which I admire, and I have worked for Microsoft on these issues, so take it with a grain of salt, is that you disclose that information to the extent that it's necessary to serve interconnection purposes between their operating system and everybody else's application. The European order goes far broader. And the sanction is, we'll just fine the hell out of you or keep your products out. So there's nothing which says that you can't force the disclosure of trade secrets. And here's the following thing. Once they are disclosed in the Netherlands, they're disclosed in the world. It just takes you about a second to get it anywhere at any time. So that trade secrets have this real risk that once there's a chink anywhere in the world system, everybody else falls asunder with respect to it. So the overall balance on this then gets back to your larger issue, which is what's the fate of private property in the world? Well, domestically, we aren't so good at dealing with that with respect to land, particularly land use rights, which are recognized under private law, receive very weak constitutional protection, which is something that all my property students, several of whom are in this room, remember hearing about at great length during many courses. But even more than that, it's harder with respect to intellectual property because it's difficult to think of a natural rights system for intellectual property. You must have a state grant or power that's created with respect to it. And so all these governments are saying, look, even if Locke was right that bottoms-up property works with respect to land, I don't know how a first possession system works without a patent examiner, for example, and we just don't want to do the examinations that way. I don't think that argument is a knockdown winner, but it certainly is the point that the locus of state power will increase to the extent that it is commonly assumed that these rights are created by government fiat or government government grant. And if you look in the United States, patents and copyrights are both subject to the Article I powers of Congress, and there's no duty whatsoever on the part of Congress to create intellectual property rights. And if there isn't, then even if you respect the existing patents, 20 years from now, you're back in a state of nature. So this problem is not going to go away, and if you're going to win it, there's not going to be first principles that win it. Essentially, you're going to have to be able to persuade people that they have to put aside their short-term opportunism in order to get long-term consistent development. And the difficulty here is we have a prisoner's dilemma again. Every nation says it's wonderful if India respects property rights and will chisel in Thailand. And then what happens is you could easily get a degenerative equilibrium in which everybody will chisel because everybody else is chiseled, at which point the system will become much weaker and all will be the losers in the long run in virtue of the fact that they can't sustain essentially the innovation that takes place. And as I said before, it's only that this is the difference between the left and the right. People on the left in general assume, well, you change the reward structure, what happens is you did the same thing you did before, only you get less. Whereas people on the right said, you change the reward structure, you'll change the behaviors that you observe. And my plea is understand elasticity, and this issue will become a lot clearer. And Saul's about to kill me, so I'm going to say thank you for your attention.
Terrific, and maybe it's worth mentioning the questions were really great too. So thank you.